Less than 1% of the profs in black Southern colleges are white. Well, obviously, it indicates discrimination, right? I mean, they must be blocking. I don't think that's it at all. I think there's a better explanation. I think a lot of white PhDs are frankly not interested in teaching at black colleges because they're typically underfunded. They don't pay very good salaries. They don't have good equipment and so forth. So I would say beware of playing the numbers game. And somebody say, you're out of sync with respect to the percentage, therefore you're discriminating. Okay. I would also think that worry harries the numbers game and played with how can we put a sunset clause. Well, whenever you got 15% blacks across the board in all work roles, including all the professions, it may well be that blacks are not interested in certain professions. Maybe blacks aren't interested in playing professional hockey or something. I mean, what do you do? I mean, I think this is really worrisome. But let's get into some nitty-gritty here. If you're in favor of affirmative action, strong affirmative action, how would you justify, how would you morally justify instituting and maintaining affirmative action programs? Well, really, there are two moral rationales that you see trotted out in the public forum for defending strong affirmative action, morally defending. One of them, here's a big phrase here, is the compensatory justice rationale. Now, that's a real bibful. But you see the word compensation in there? I mean, what this is an argument that blacks need to be compensated for the ill treatment that we whites have dealt them in the past. Now, I can't throw this rationale out the window because I think we all believe that if somebody has harmed another person, the harmer owes the harmee one. Right? I mean, we ought to make amends. Compensation ought to be rendered. So I don't have any problem with this. It's right at the heart of my own moral belief. And so now the general case here is that the reason we should practice affirmative action, that the reason it's justified to give preferential treatment to lesser qualified blacks over more qualified whites, is to make compensation for past harms done to them from the era of slavery right through favoritistic, discriminatory hiring practices. So we're making amends. This is a backwards-looking rationale, okay? It's usually the one we hear. Fade to gray. There is another rationale which is not backwards-looking. It cares not a whit, or at least in public face, it cares not a whit, about making compensation to harm parties from the past. Rather, it's entirely future-oriented. The answer to the question, why should we generate affirmative action programs, is this. In order to bring about, in the future, a society, a workforce, in which blacks and whites have equal opportunity to get jobs based purely on their talents and their abilities without the impress of anything else. Okay? This is really forward-looking. Why are you doing this now? Well, because we have a goal out there we want to achieve in the future of a more egalitarian society where jobs are given on the basis of capabilities and so forth. We have, you know, I mean, it's a forward-looking thing. Now, you don't often hear that, but that last rationale, but I think I personally gravitate more toward that one than I do the compensatory justice rationale, and let me tell you why. I just think the compensatory justice rationale, the backward-looking one, which says we need to get affirmative action business in order to make amends for harms done to these people, I think it's saddled with so many difficulties that I'm just casting about saying, is there some other way I can possibly justify this? And this leads me more toward wanting to accept the futuristic rationale, which is not backward looking and in the amends making mode. Let me tell you why. I mean, this is just some salted peanuts. I mean, what I'm about to tell you about the compensatory justice rationale is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it's just riddled with problems. I really didn't recognize until 5 years ago at my advanced age after teaching philosophy. Suddenly, bonk, you know, I'm sitting there reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Now this is the real Aristotle, not the one that married Jackie. You know, a lot of my students get that confused. But reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and he's talking about the criteria for rendering compensatory justice or amends making. And I'm sitting there going, wow, this is really interesting. This guy is speaking to 1997. Now just hear him out, okay? If you've got some case in which somebody A has harmed B, so A owes B one, compensation, okay? Aristotle lays down a bunch of criteria which he thinks are exhaustive of what has to happen in order for compensatory justice to be rendered. Number one, first criterion, is that the proper, indeed the only party that has a moral responsibility to make amends to the harm party is the party who has perpetrated the harm, not somebody else, but the party who's perpetrated the harm. Second, the second principle here is that the only party who truly merits and deserves and ought to be given compensation is someone who has truly been harmed and not somebody else in that person's stead. Got it? And the third one is the criterion for knowing when you can call it quits. Compensation is satisfied when the harmed party is restored to the status that he or she would have been had not the original harm occurred. Okay? Now let's go back to criterion one. Criterion one is that the only party that properly should make compensation is he or she who has perpetrated the harm. Now, it takes about 1 nanosecond for my 18 to 21 year old students when they hear this and say, but, what? Okay, we get almost a unison raise of hands from most of the white males in the class and say, trust me, I can say in truth, I have never discriminated against anybody. I have never. Maybe my dad did, maybe my granddad did, I didn't. But when I start pounding the pavement, looking for a job, and then I see these interesting claims, we are an equal opportunity, affirmative action employer. I mean, my white students tell me, well, they might as well hang out a sign, white males need not apply. I mean, really? And they say that they are taking a hit. That is to say, that they're losing jobs, what? In order to make amends to people? But they never discriminated. And so now you've got somebody that's not a perpetrator that's paying a price, and he said Aristotle's first criterion is violated. And then some other students, takes a little while for this to bubble up, you know, end up saying, but it's certainly true that there are some, let's say, blacks who show up in an office petitioning for jobs and so forth, who get favoritistic treatment, who really are not victims. I mean, they come from upper or middle class, you know, families and so forth, have had good educations and so forth, you know, and they still get favorite. I mean, the thumb is still on the scale there. The question is, are they really a victim? Doesn't seem so to my students. And so, in their case, I mean, think of Bill Cosby's kids or something. I mean, have really been victimized? I mean, it'll give them a little thumb on the scale. Now, I mean, so in this case, Aristotle's second criterion is violated. And then you can play with Aristotle's second criterion and just sort of stretch it out a little bit. Remember, the second criterion is only those who are truly victims should receive compensation. Right. But with a little tweaking, I think, you know, you can go on, Eric didn't say this, but you could tweak that principle and go on and say, and not only should all those who have been harmed receive compensation, but they should receive compensation proportionate to the harm that they experienced. Right? I mean, that shouldn't surprise anyone. Proportionate to the harm. Now, this is already suggesting that the level of harm experienced by everyone is not equal. Now, then you can come back and say, now here's another problem with compensatory justice rationale. Who is it that gets the favoritistic treatment? It's those who, according to the announced qualifications of the classified, qualify for the job. Only if you qualify do we then put the thumb on the scale. Okay, now the question is, those blacks that qualify have arguably not been harmed as much as that whole group of blacks out there that aren't even at the threshold of qualification. So to whom is it that you're given, that affirmative action is giving the treatments exactly to those who need it least? Okay? They can start turning the screws on this thing. I think a lot of this stuff has answers, but that's what we'll get into, you know, later. Right? Then, let's just go on a little excursus here. I'm just trying to pump this up now and widen. If we're talking about compensatory justice, then I would think that that's purely generic. That anyone, absolutely anyone, who marches into a job interview or something and is not as qualified as someone else because some discrimination has been done against them in the past is probably owed one. Now, what I'm trying to do here is, okay, let's just concede that blacks have been discriminated against. And so we're going to give the benefit of the doubt to white males. Are there any white males walking on American soil that are members of sets of white males which arguably have been discriminated against in the past or now? Let's just take the category of white males. Any white males who could claim that they are from a discriminated against class? What would be the complexion of these people? Gays? Well, I was gonna get to that. Then you can, you know, expand it. Say, are there any other groups besides blacks? Oh, well, Irish, anybody else? Any other groups which are not, you know, ethnic minorities that have been discriminated in American history?
Hillbillies?
Japanese.
Immigrants.
Immigrants? Okay.
Yeah. Or, I mean, handicapped, I guess.
Handicapped? Yeah. I mean, Okies, I mean, have got some hillbilly drawl, you know, kind of, I mean, just the way they speak and everything that they're discriminated against. Now look, I'll bet you every one of these people could run a case that because my dad and granddad have been discriminated against, you know, because I'm from the South and when I talk I don't sound very educated or something of the sort, or I'm from an Irish family and I was discriminated against, you know, in my family. Every one of those people could run an argument that because they came from stock that was originally discriminated against, that they are not now as well off as they would have been had their ancestors not been discriminated against. It would have been cumulative. Every one of them could run an argument, could they? But let's forget about race and ethnic discrimination. Let's just, I want to ask the question, is discrimination, are harms stemming from discrimination the only kind of harms that might make a person less qualified in the now than he or she might have been? I mean, do all the harms which disqualify people come from discrimination? I don't think so. I mean, this is an imaginative thing. Suppose my grandfather owned a restaurant down in the south side of Chicago or something, owned a restaurant, and one day a bunch of toughs, you know, walk in and said, it's interesting here, your workforce unionized? No, sir, I'm going to have nothing to do with the union. I don't want a union. Not a union shop. Got a bunch of good people working here. And they say, well, you might want to think about that because, you know, there's been some funny things happening to businesses around here that don't hire unions. We just thought maybe you'd like to know that. Well, he's an adamant person, says, I'm not going to be bullied. The next thing you know, my granddad's restaurant is torched. And there's nothing, and he's got no insurance. He's bankrupt, okay? Now, my dad is his son, and now look where we're at in terms of financial solvency. The kind of education my dad gets and the opportunities available to him are not as good as if my granddad had made a good living with the restaurant. I'm my dad's son, and you know, poverty sort of breeds poverty, and so, okay, now look, I am not as qualified in competing for many of these jobs, not as a result of any harm proceeding for discrimination. Am I? But I am a victim. Now, I would think if you're going to compensate anybody who's less qualified than he or she would be had not some harm happened in the past would put them at a disadvantage, that everybody who's a victim should be compensated, right? I mean, by what grounds do we simply single out compensation for harms proceeding from discrimination? And discrimination against blacks. So you're going to get in the compensatory business, it seems to me, you're just going to get suffocated by all these problems as to how it is you select one kind of harm to rectify by affirmative action. I mean, why not victims of other sorts of harms, which also make current contenders for jobs less qualified than they might be? I don't know. I don't know how you avoid this kind of turmoil. This is some of the reasons as to why I don't want to touch this thing with a 10-foot pole. It just bristles with the difficulties here. And it's not that this future, you know, bringing about a more egalitarian society in the future rationale, which is the alternative, it's not that that doesn't have any problems with it. I think it does. Problem number one is if you get into that business, I still think we're left high and dry with respect to some kind of plausible criterion for deciding when we've achieved the golden age. I mean, are you going to play the numbers game and if there's 15% blacks in all positions? I worry about that. So, and number one is I'm not sure what the criterion would be to know when I can quit. And then somebody might come along and say, well, this is really interesting. You want to embark on an affirmative action program of a strong type in order to bring about a better society in the future, more egalitarian workforce and stuff. Somebody might say, I don't think, Peters, that I think you ought to go to a reality checkpoint. Because somebody might argue that really, and they might point to what's happening nowadays, black churches burning, all this kind of stuff. They might point to the realistic probability, in their view, that what's going to happen. I mean, you want to know what's going to happen if we continue practicing affirmative action? That's going to lead to a more polarized society between black and whites than a more race-neutral, gender-neutral, isn't it? I mean, whites are just going to get tired of this. White males, and they're going to react. Are they reacting now? I mean, somebody may say, you have a really optimistic view, Peters, as to what's going to happen. It's going to boomerang. It's not going to ring in the kingdom of God. We're going to go to hell in a handbasket. Well, this is the difference in predictions concerning what would happen. That's probably a standoff. I don't know about that one. I just don't know about that. Somebody might say, another problem with this future orientation thing is if you want to bring about a better society in the future, a more egalitarian workforce, and that's why you're doing it, there is a real cost to that, Peters, a real cost. And one of the costs is this, is that if you chronically practice giving jobs, let's say, to lesser qualified blacks over more qualified whites, that is to say, the minute you fudge the minute American industry fudges the principle of giving the job to the most qualified, American industry is going to become even less competitive in an international market than it is now. Now, the hypothesis is that the more qualified you are, the more productive you're going to be. It's going to turn to greater shares and dividends for shareholders and so forth, and it's finally going to bring us around to some sort of a compatibility with the Japanese and so forth. I mean, it's like saying this is a kamikaze mission to go around hiring lesser qualified people or more qualified people. I mean, it's casting profits to the wind. It's casting our international competitiveness to the wind. That's a tough one. I think what finally we end up wrestling with here is whether the only uno mono reason for being a business is to maximize profits for shareholders. Is that it? Period? QED? I mean, Uncle Milty Friedman down at the University of Chicago says, right! It's that simple. I mean, the function of business is to increase shareholders for profits. I mean, it's that quick. But now what we're asking here is sort of an interesting ultimate question. If the cost of bringing about a more egalitarian society in the future is pitted against what I'll just call efficiency of American business, why does efficiency necessarily trump the goal of bringing about a more egalitarian society? Is it obvious that on a scale of 1 to 10, efficiency is more important than some sort of just society? I mean, that's an ultimate standoff. Some people say, yeah, it's easy for them. Profits and efficiency are, you know, let justice take the hindmost. But then you got other people say, like Plato and others, the first virtue of every society is justice. That's the first thing. I mean, it's Archimedean principle. An unjust society, it doesn't matter how efficient it is, how rich it is. If it's unjust, it still takes a hit morally, you know? Let's see, what do we got? Let me just quit there. There's just tons to talk about, but you know, rather than talk at you, might be more productive to just open it up. Yeah, sure.
Well, it seems that one of the areas that is certainly worth debate is what is it that we call these qualifications? Because I'm sitting here thinking of example after example of, so I have two candidates for a position, and how do I judge, and they both cross this threshold mm-hmm. that you talked about, and how do I decide one is more or less qualified? And what comes into that, a lot of that is not hard numbers. I mean, you can get rid of whether it's numbers, whether it's years of experience, or it's how many degrees, or it's this or that, or whatever. Because a lot of what becomes the qualifications becomes, and this both feeds the negative always hiring people who look like you versus could also feed the idea of what it is you're trying to accomplish, because you're trying to look for effectiveness of the person for whatever the goals are of what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, there are so many jobs where effectiveness does not come into a hard number, whether you're nearly any of the professional jobs. I mean, how do you judge effectiveness? How do you judge what that particular thing is? And the hiring person is the one who makes this call on who they think is going to be the most effective. And what happens, I mean, women's gripe to the old boys network is that the white male is always going to hire the white male because he's more comfortable with him, because he can go play golf with him, because he can go do all these other kinds of things with him. Where the women say, but wait a minute, I have a different, perhaps an enriching way of making decisions, of bringing in more facts and opinions to bear on a decision-making process and so on. So that's where, when you set up these two paradigms really, one the compensatory, and one the futuristic, some of that still comes back to then how you know, what happens in that hiring decision, whether I'm looking at either one of those models.
Let me wager a guess. I think that personnel officers, let's say 3M near us, personnel officers, when they develop this list of qualifications, which you should be able to meet if you're going to be an applicant, I think they work hard on that. And from their point of view, they probably admit that they could be mistaken, that there may be other qualifications that would speak to being really well, a nice performance. But I think that most of them think that they've ambushed or stated explicitly the ones that are really relevant. And so they're virtually willing to equate their list of characteristics with the very definition of competency.
I think part of the argument has come about. Let's say that, then for sake of argument, that I have two equivalently qualified people, and one's black and one's white.
Mm-hmm.
And if then the hiring practices consistently always choose the white one, I mean, that's where you can still look at the numbers later on.
Right.
They always choose the white one. You've got to say, no, wait a minute.
No, that isn't fair. And that's a classic case of equals are not treated equally. Okay, that's a violation of the formal principle of justice. How about this, though? I would want to toss this into the category of weak affirmative action. Suppose you have neck and neck. You've got two people that cross the threshold of competency and they're both equally qualified. One's a black and one's a white. Now, suppose in that case, I simply say, in that case, I give favoritistic treatment to the black. I mean, I'm not getting anything less for my money. Is that bad? Is that bad? I mean, this is interesting. Is that unjust that I let it be a tiebreaker, skin color?
I think that at the heart of the debate is, you know, the overwhelming thing that comes to my mind is that there are a lot of whites in this country who do not really see that racism is still the major issue in this country, particularly for blacks, for Native Americans, for, you know, for a number of other groups, but particularly for blacks. And you know, when you look at the scenario you just described, I'm real scared to see us get rid of affirmative action, because has it done what it's supposed to do? I think the answer is no. I mean, I don't think we're done. You can look in any community and talk to black teenagers and ask them what they think about their future possibilities and how they feel about racial issues in this country, and they are extremely bitter. They are extremely angry. I mean, you don't even have to know anybody personally to see this. I mean, all you have to do is look at, you know, gangs and what kids are doing and how they're feeling and their anger and how it's being pent up. And I think that they don't see that they have a future. They don't see that they're, you know, they don't see equality. And this is one thing that the government has at least done to try to provide some opportunity, and they see that being taken away, and it's really making a serious impact. But I think that let's take the scenario where the white applicant is more qualified than the black applicant, although they both are qualified. I think there have been times where had that black applicant been not hired, they may never have been able to get into the workforce to then become more qualified.
And then you can start the snowball effect. If you don't get these people in their invisible positions, you have no role models
for
blacks to emulate. You see, now we have the boomerang effect.
I think that, you know, fair, not fair, I don't care what it does to the rest of us. I think that we've got to continue programs where blacks and other color groups, other everybody who doesn't fit in the mainstream, you know, nice little white pocket that we have. I think we've got to continue programs that keep the people employed, and I have some personal reasons why I really feel the black community needs it in particular, because I'm with these kids all the time and see, you know, how they're feeling, and they are angry. I mean, they're angry at Christianity because you know, all these crimes have been done to every group there is by whites in the name of Christianity, and they fit, you know, they just have all these strong feelings. And I think that unless you can get blacks in responsible positions in the workforce and keep them there and keep them succeeding, you're right, there will be no role models for these kids. And they will not have a chance to ever get into the workforce, because, I mean, we can sit here and say all we want that, you know, oh, it's gotten better and it isn't that bad and racism really isn't a big issue, and that's just plain bullshit. It is.
Well, I like the way you put it. I agree with the word plain. Here's a really interesting thought experiment. People like Charles Murray, author of the
Bell Curve,
and so forth, and others, and I think George Bush, the whole Bush administration was of this particular mindset. I think that if you ask them, I know Murray would say this because he's written an article called Affirmative Racism, and that's where I got part of my title. But he's written an article. He really and truly believes this, that if we would pass a federal law, this is just a thought experiment, if we pass a federal law that says any company or institution like a school system or anything that beginning January 1, 1998, if we catch any company practicing strong affirmative action, the way I've just described it, we're gonna fine that company, maybe make some of their personnel officers serve time. I mean, we're gonna make a crime to do that. So don't you dare do it. Now, this is interesting, it'd be illegal. What kind of confidence, just shooting from the hip right now, what kind of confidence do you have that the hiring, promoting, and contract awards where affirmative action was illegal would be done entirely on the basis of merit? Now, how confident are you of that? Now, I think Murray is very confident. He thinks that affirmative action policies are not holding open any doors that would otherwise be closed to blacks if we didn't have affirmative action. He thinks the civil rights movement has done its job, that there's enough guilt, operative and personnel officers, to mean that they're really struggling like men to be race and gender neutral.
And now
the question is, you know, well, how do you, I mean, what kind of confidence do you have in that? If we made it illegal, would we see, right? See, they're just operating on the basis of merit. Now, if you don't believe that, the question is reopened. Maybe we can't put a sunset clause on it. See?
I was thinking things come and go, and there's a certain goodness on having the fight. A good ending can come out of a good fight with people because they passionately believe in what they're stating. The Bush people passionately believed these ideas. And I have somewhat been changed to see positive effects from the social Darwinism that the Reagan people preached so hard on. And being the United States, I think, is a wonderful democratic experiment. And the machinery is there to change it. Either way, they people that have the thoughts that you were talking about, the bell curve people, have had a considerable amount of power for the last 20 years. But trends come and go. The Johnson people maybe were too strong. and promoted laziness, which is one of the big arguments of the Bush people, is that the underclasses got lazy because they didn't have to struggle. So the fault comes back on us for not fulfilling our obligations as citizens, and the lesser classes vote less, participate in government less, and...
What are our obligations?
To participate in the...
With respect to, let's say, blacks, what are our obligations? With respect
all citizens, though, are obligated to participate in democracy, yeah. I think, if they yeah. want the benefits of it.
Yeah. Okay.
And when things get in people's interest enough, they will participate.
Ah, but suppose it's not in their interest. I just gave you an argument, which I hear from business people, that affirmative action, which will hire a lesser qualified candidate over a more black or a more qualified white, scales productivity, which leads to lesser return on the dollar and less competitiveness in the international market. That's why we can't afford it, says business. It's not in our interest.
Yeah, but that's right. And that's there. And the fight between the people that say, hey, no, it's in our interest to have a social justice and an egalitarian society. It's in our interest. We have to fight in the marketplace of ideas against the people that think that profit is the only motive, because that is their only motive.
That's right. They're myopic, maybe with a total set of values. Let me bait people a little bit here. Some real deep thinkers, whether deep doesn't mean, on target, but they thought about this issue a lot. And these deep thinkers have said, let's just home in on this notion, or the status of being the most qualified for a job, okay? And let's just take a little history and ask, what are the ingredients of producing a person that's most qualified for the job? Now, let's do a little historical trip. Who are these people? And the proposition I want to put in front of you, which is defended by these people, and that's a breathtaking proposition, is that if you think long enough about it, the people who are answered to the status most qualified, listen to this, don't deserve their qualifications. Now, how is that? They don't deserve them, okay? Well, somebody's graduated from a prestigious Eastern school. Question, well, how did they get into that school? Well, they performed well. Let's say they were the valedictorian of their class. They performed well on SAT. Well, how did that come about? Well, now you get into the causal nexus here. Well, they came from a pretty well-to-do family. Family lived in like Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or Dinah, Minnesota, or some real uppity community. Kid was sent to a good school, good teachers, funded by, the whole school system funded from a tax base, property tax base, with pretty wealthy people, okay? Now, can the kid take any credit? I'm just pushing it all the way. Can he take any credit, first of all, let's start back at square one, for being born to these parents? Is that something he deserves? Does he deserve to be born to the... Well, that's just an accident, okay? Can he take any credit? Can he prune his feathers and say, and I went to, Bloomfield Hills High School, or... Lake Forest, Illinois, or something. Can they get any credit for that? That's just right? Just happened to, okay? And of course, he happened to have good teachers. Can he prune his feathers and say, well, no, that's my doing too, you know, that I have good teachers, okay? And let's just suppose he had a family that was really concerned rather than had no concern about the child's education. I mean, you know, they took trips to the zoo, poetry readings at the Hungry Mind, you know, and we go to Venezuela and we have all these kinds of things. Can he prune his feathers and say, oh, no, I mean, these are all mine. I deserve them. And he's been handed to him on a golden platter. Okay? You say, oh, well, but he used what capabilities, you know, he had, natural endowment and so forth, and at least motivated. But then what some of these people want to go back and say, but it's really interesting that whether or not he's motivated strongly or poorly, again, could it be a result of familial input? I mean, it could be a kid that comes home and before he can go out and play ball, you're going to do your homework and you're not going to, you know, do this and so forth. Well, how did he come by his qualifications? It looked like if you ask for the recipe for being the most qualified, he doesn't deserve his qualifications because they're the result of a whole conjunction of events over which he didn't exercise any control. That's a remarkable thesis that no one deserves their qualifications. I mean, that sounds like you can get away with murder here.
Well, and what about the white male who is, you know, from a fairly well-to-do family going to school with the token minorities in the school, and the white male still comes up if they're, you know, he's the one who gets the A for his essay and the minority gets, you know, the B minus, so the white male comes up with the, you know, the better grade point average so that when he, you know, when scholarships are given out, who goes to the more prestigious colleges and so on like that, and it's favoritism even.
And it could be that the black child, I mean, let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's just say there isn't any innate difference in intellectual abilities between blacks and whites. Okay, let's start with that. Then what makes the difference in a performance between the black child and the white child in the same school? It could well have to do with family.
Or treatment.
And how they stick it to him, or just he's a latchkey kid, or whatever it is. But then even something is, well, now we're not even talking about his natural endowments, we're talking about his level of motivation and commitment to education.
You have to take that to even not just white males and minorities. In our school system, favoritism of boy children, for instance, in sciences and math over girls, and there isn't as much, you know, care given to, say, girls to achieve well in the sciences and the math, and so therefore a lot of times unless they have a parent that is really motivated to see that they succeed in those, they're overlooked, and so their chances of getting the, you know, into engineering and stuff like that is out the window because it's just nobody's paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. Because girls are supposed to be homemakers or want to be cheerleaders or whatever, waitresses.
And they're victimized. I mean, it's like a harm done to them. Okay? Now, do harms need to get rectified? And then how do we do that? Is the whole business of affirmative action in the business when we say, okay, we're going to hire a lesser qualified black over a more qualified white? Why are we doing that? Well, we're saying, now, taking an all-seeing angel's view, we're going back and saying, doggone it, this lesser qualified black would be, this is a counterfactual, as qualified as the most qualified white candidate, hit from one way or another with all these harms, you know, that were not experienced by the white. And that's why we're doing it. I mean, this is a huge exercise in reconstruction that had not this happened and that happened and that happened, they would be equally qualified. And so now that's the alleged justification for hiring a lesser qualified.
There's some biblical implications too about the evil being passed on to the succeeding generations that comes into this kind of thinking too. You know, if you think about your model of the family, your family that you're talking about, if that's your real family or not, but the, you know, your grandfather in the restaurant business, and then your father being in poverty because that business was destroyed, but still there's that model way back there of success and a fighting will, you know, that's attached to that model that other people might not have.
So anyone who's not the most qualified, you can explain it away by saying, well, you see, they're not as qualified as my most qualified because they suffered all these kinds of things in the past. And it wasn't their fault.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't discriminate people against people for things that aren't their fault. And that's what we're trying to do. Yeah? No, she was beckoning to you to...
Well, I think that equal employment opportunity, maybe as we look at what we've done with it in the last 30 or 40 years in terms of thinking and then doing, and the word employment implies that it all has to start at age 18, but that's when we get it. It seems to me that equal employment opportunity needs to start at least with a toddler. And that there are some ways to rethink what we're doing in terms of justice and equality for people, to look back and say where the problem really is back where all of the things we're looking at that make it so that we have to count noses and say, okay, you need to hire this person or that. That looking at the whole concept as saying preschool education, it's equality of opportunity for employment, you know, 18
right.
years from now or 14 years from now begins at infancy or at age 3.
Now this is really interesting because what we just heard is an alternative proposal. If we, now just take the forward-looking a rationale, the reason we're into affirmative action is to bring about, in the future, a more egalitarian society with equal opportunity to be hired, promoted, get contracts and so forth, simply on the basis of qualifications, right? Without the intrusion of anything else. That's what we want to bring about. Now, what we're doing now is sending out an all points bulletin asking, all right, if that's the vision, if that's the goal, is the policy of giving favoritistic treatment now to lesser qualified blacks or for more qualified whites, is that the most efficient way of bringing about the vision we want to achieve? And an alternative proposal here is, why don't we just scrap affirmative action, and bomb and inter it, and that the modus operandi for bringing about this more egalitarian future is to start right back in the primary school setting or preschool, whatever it is, and make sure that the education which is gotten by blacks and whites is equal. So that by the time they get down there to take the SAT and so forth to get in, that they can compete. Now, is that a better way of doing it? I mean, if we're going to bring about this more egalitarian society, why don't we just scrap affirmative action and go back to square one? Now, what I'm thinking is going to be the case is that if we're going to beef up the primary and secondary education of blacks so that by the time on the eve of graduation from high school they can compete equally for slots in good schools with whites, if we're going to do that, it wouldn't surprise me that we're going to have to practice favoritism in our allocation of the education dollar and dump more money into black schools and give the white schools less money. And now I think the human cry is going to go up. There you go again. See? Why are you doing this? See, this is just discrimination under another name.
I think that that's something in addition to. I mean, I think that with all the laws that have been enacted in states to beef up the multicultural curriculum and environment in early childhood settings as well as in public school system. I mean, I think that's certainly something that they're working on. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's when you say...
Well, I thought this was what you were plumping for, really. Implicitly, the alternative.
Oh, just an alternative. Well, I think it's something you have to probably do in addition.
Both
ends.
What would be wrong in this, where it making it bipolar? Somebody say, okay, let's just scrap affirmative action, and instead do this beef up.
What would be
okay, what's the problem with that? Can you see?
Well, we can have one whole generation that's going to miss out on everything.
That's right. You've got people through the going through the pipe now that are already beyond. And the question is, what are we just kissing them off and abandoning them?
And
say sorry.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, blacks typically have to be better to be equal. I mean, they have to be better to
overcome
be seen as. They do. They have to be better to be seen as being equal. I mean, in the minds of a whole bunch of people. And I think that if you don't have something, and I'm not saying that affirmative action the way it's been for 30 years is, you know, the perfect model, but I certainly don't think you can scrap that kind of action, because there's a whole lot of employers that the only reason they are hiring blacks is because somebody has told them they had to. And if somebody told them they didn't have to, it's not like the job is done and it's going to stay that way. I mean, it will revert back right to where it was in a lot of employment settings if there isn't some kind of check and balance in place. So I think you've got to do it on a whole bunch of different levels. But I certainly don't think that maybe the model that we've had is the perfect one. I think it needs reworking. But I think if we scrap it, we're in for a nightmare.
You know, this may seem to be curious logic, but you pointed out something interesting, that in order to be, in quotes, equal to whites, and it's probably true for women, too, I mean, that you've got to just give your all in order to appear equal to the personnel officer. But then I would submit, I guess I want to turn that argument, it may be tricky argumentation, somebody saying, really what you may be getting when you have a black or a female that is equally qualified, is you may in fact be getting the more qualified person because of what they've been through. I mean, it's like a curious kind of a upshot to this, but it's not a dumb way to argue.
Well, I was just going to say, speaking to the lady over there about the preschool education and President Clinton's, you know, goals 2000, and that all children will be ready to enter school at age 5, and that all children will be reading by third grade. I mean, if we could actually meet those goals, you know, I think we would be well off, you know, later on.
Yeah. But here's the lingering question I have. Even if we went this route, even if we had a two-pronged thing, we keep affirmative action, we're not going to hire unqualified people, but we're willing to make it, and then start working on the basic educational ladder, okay? Now, what are we implicitly saying? Are we saying that if we did that, if we ensured that there was equal quality education for blacks and whites, okay, are we saying that what you'd see if we brought that into being is 20 years from now, we would see equal outcomes in terms of job hunting and job awards and so forth for blacks and whites? I'm worried about that because we have a big blind spot in all this. We're saying, what we're saying, it's tempting to believe that if we instituted this equal quality education, we're going to ring in the kingdom of God 20 years from now, we're really going to see equal qualifications. And I want to say, I think we've forgotten about two things. Something called genetic endowment. All people are not born with the same talents and degrees thereof, okay? And the other thing has to do with the preschool home life. I mean, you're already becoming aware, I mean, the newspapers and magazines, you're just rubbing our noses in the fact that you've got to be really concerned about that young infant right out of the womb, and you have to maximize the kind of environment they're in, because, I mean, right, the clock starts ticking, and maybe even it's while you're in the womb. I mean, you're giving the right kind of nutrients and so forth, and income and knowledge depend on that. So what are we talking about? Do we want equal opportunity for all concepti or something? You know, and then after that, you've got difference. I don't know how you're ever going to iron out those major differences that are going to occur prior to the start of the educational system. You're still going to have people that are ahead and behind,
well,
right?
Yeah, but perfection is just the goal. I mean, it's never going to be achieved.
Right. Now, that's no reason to say, well, see, equalizing education isn't going to do it. Well, I'm not that skeptical. I mean, right, we're not going to solve all the problems. Maybe we can go around manipulating genes so that we have the genetic endowments relatively equal, and you're able to tinker on that front, you know. But then what do? We have Big Brother staring in on parents as they raise their kids, not stimulating them enough and so forth. We want all parents to parent the same way to maximize. We're going to do it, right? You know,
that's
I don't know how to ever control that.
Flat out in the political marketplace, though, would it? Those issues have to be fought out.
But it's easy, when you're finally going to get to the privacy of the family. Parents should be able to raise your child the way they want. But right there, you're going to have these differences started.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming.
Yeah, but you see these kids coming into school that have never been read to. You know, there has got to be something, some education.
And it's not their fault.
Well, no, it's not the child's fault. It's the parents' fault,
but
you know.
We can't engineer society, and that's what it sounds like. We're engineering society. We're trying to have a goal out there. And
for a perfectly honorable motive, we're trying to engineer things so we have equality of opportunity.
But even children, you know, you have the ones that haven't been read to. Have the children that come into school that their family attitude is that school is dumb, and the parents, you never get the parents, whatever color they are or anything, they never come to school
because they had a bad experience themselves.
They never come to a parent teacher conference. They never participate in the child's education. The biggest message that they are sending to these children is that it isn't important. So the child doesn't view it as important. And so you end up with a child whose future is wasted, because by the time they're in third grade, they have such an attitude about school and they're so far behind that they never will catch up. And so they end up being an adult who works in a McDonald's, because they'll never get into a higher.
So it doesn't matter how good the school system is from point zero. If they come in with no motivation or anything, you can have all that apparatus there.
Some children are lost. They're disposed of before they reach the educational system.
So we're not going to resolve the great society by just that.
You go to the store and you see these people, you just want to slap them upside of the head because the way they're treating their own children. They're precious commodity, and they're treating them.
I think you're intruding, though, if you're attracting people to a good idea, and being a good parent is a good idea. You don't have to mandate it.
Right. Well, if you mandate it, I don't know how you enforce it.
So attracting them to those ideas, through churches and
providing opportunities for parents,
creating opportunities to learn. It doesn't have to be. Not everybody is interested in the church, but mentoring situations.
So you're not in favor, are you in favor of this two-pronged approach, and we keep affirmative action, because we still got people coming through the pipe that are not going to be touched by a revised educational system, and we've got to do something about them? I mean, they're going to be armies, and then we should work on the other front at the same time. But still keep
yes, I am. Actually, I am for a plethora of different approaches. Every individual kid is an individual situation, or every individual person has his own, and we're going to be mentored in different, by institutions, by different people, strong people in our lives, right? But good or bad.
You shouldn't make companies hire, just somebody because of their color, just to get them in, because they were started, like she said, at the beginning with no education, and then you want to bring them in because you got to meet a quota.
I remember a situation in your company. You were saying that these Asians that you're hiring, they're the best workers. You just wouldn't believe it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I'm talking about the total colorless situation. It happens across the board.
Across the board.
In every ethnic, situation where you have parents that don't value. I mean, the key to getting ahead and being the qualified person is the education. And if you have a parent, if you're unfortunate enough to be born in a family where your parents don't value education, someone else has to mentor you, someone else has to get to that child and be the person that will get them sparked for the education
support.
That they support them or whatever to get them so that they can make it on their own, because obviously they're not getting the support from their parents. And it isn't a black issue, it isn't a minority issue. There's, you know, it is across the board. I could, you know, name.
I really do agree with that.
It's terrible, and as a society, we have really fallen down on not supporting or not educating or helping our parents be adequate parents. You have to take a test to be a driver, but you don't have to know nothing to be a parent, and nobody cares. And we have 16-year-olds having children with no skills, and they're angry. They have children because they're already angry at the way they've been raised. So to get back at their parents, they don't even know why, but to get back is to go out and have children. I'll show you. And so then you have a 16-year-old who's already angry, who's become a parent, and then they're trying to raise a child. They don't have any skills. They have no work skills. They don't have parenting skills. And you have these, you know, generations that are 16 to 18 years difference. You have people that are grandparents at 43. You know, I mean, it's...
Or less, yeah.
Or less.
But,
or less.
I sure don't agree with you, though, that nobody cares. Cause, you know, well, like, there's all kinds of...
Well, I think there's... I think people care, but I think it's a... We're so touchy about intervening or trying to get to these people and help them when there is a stage or a point where you can help them. And a lot of times, by the time I've known, worked through PTA for years at our school, and a lot of times by the time these children get into kindergarten, the mold is already set, and you can work with them and you can work with them and you can work with them, but the biggest influence on them comes from their family. You only have them for 6 hours every day, and you're regulated as to what you can pump into these kids. You pump it in and it just goes right out the other end when they get
home. How do we deal with this? If this is the crux of the matter.
I don't know.
I mean, like, we're right in the holy of holies now. I mean, this is it.
I say you got to have good uncles.
But it seems to be an untouchable.
Right?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Good uncles?
Is there you gotta have good uncles, you know, whatever. You know, neighbors, good neighbors.
Well, I think the key is education. You know, educating these
parents.
Yeah,
but we're already talking, no one doubts that.
Getting back to getting these parents educated as to how to raise children. That's what I mean. You know, and it starts.
Well, it's amazing how this week is going. Before you came, Steve, I mean, last week we had a debate on whether parents ought to be licensed, that you shouldn't. You wouldn't have a license to procreate unless you passed
well, that's what you said. Yeah.
My God, listen to this. No, we're even.
Oh, the people advocating this last week?
Oh, well, we did. Voluntarily. We sort of got defeated. Oh. Now we entertain these unbelievable space cadet kind of things where I told a group last week that some welfare agency guy in the welfare division of Wisconsin, Department of Health and Human Services, told me one time, you know, this problem with teenage pregnancies, you know, 14, 15-year-old girls get pregnant. I mean, they're not capable of, you know, it's all accident. And he said, you know, really, what we ought to do here, just think about this. He said, he said that obstetricians, some obstetrician gynecologists he had talked to, were confident that within the next decade, that both forms of human sterilization, vasectomy and tubal ligations, would be clearly reversible. Okay, I mean, we're already into it now, it's sort of experimental, but decade from now would be like doing a tonsillectomy. I mean, it's, you know, it's just, if that era comes, he said, why don't we just have a public policy that the girl's tubes get tied at birth, all right? Boy gets a vasectomy, and then at such time that they're able to parent, they have it reversed. But then you don't have any pregnancies that you don't want. You don't have teenagers, you know, mothers, and so. I mean, you talk about a multiple pronged approach. So I said, oh, it takes your breath away. Really? But how would that? Why is that a terrible constraint of a girl's liberty? Really? Is it really? Well, I'm not at liberty to get pregnant when I don't want to? Is that what you, I mean, that's a strange form of liberty.
But you know, the years ago, my parents both worked in a mental institution, and years ago, you know, they stopped. There was a practice at one time, and I don't know how many years ago, where they would, female patients, they would, or there would be sterilization, and that was stopped. Even when these people did not have the reasoning powers to even know,
right.
You know, they have the creature urge, but not the, they didn't know what they were even doing. And they could be 30 years old, and you would end up with patients.
All those mandatory sterilization laws for, remember the jargon years ago, the mentally enfeebled? I mean, nobody talks like that. It's a mean language.
Right.
They were passed in the early 20s and 30s, and the amazing thing about it is that all these slippery slope people say, oh my God, here we go, we're sterilizing, you know, involuntarily, people whose mental facilities are genetically, you know, messed up. And so, where are we going to go with this? We're going to start sterilizing people with opposing...
The way Hitler's thought.
Yeah, right. But the proof fact is it never happened. It never happened. Right now, all those laws have either been repealed or they aren't enforced. So we didn't go that route.
Yeah, but we just start down that.
Except you're just saying.
I know, but we backed away.
Yeah, lobotomies, I was thinking.
We backed away.
Yeah, yes, right.
So I'm worried.
That's what I say about the experiment of the American democracies, is we have the ability to change. And that's very, maybe not totally unique in the world, but it's...
Well, that's why I resist this easy notion that... You know, if we allow physician-assisted suicide, a la Jack Kevorkian, you know, we're going to go all the way to Hitler in Germany, right? I thought, wait. I mean, then somebody says, well, don't you know what we did to the Japanese? Don't tell us that we don't have, that we don't put people in concentration camps, da-da-da-da-da. I say, yeah, so don't give me this nonsense that Americans aren't cuffing the same stuff. But I think you can rebut that with something like this historical example about what we did with mandatory sterilization. We backed down. I could run a horror story of where it would go, but it didn't.
But that doesn't mean to say that won't happen in the future either. Depending, our country is different now than it was in the 20s. We, you know, there are many more...
Well, you may be right. I mean, with the skinheads and the militias around, and I mean, the overt acts of racism,
human condition's pretty consistent.
And we don't have a more.
Well, I don't know where.
It's relative. Everything is more.
Man can not live by philosophy alone.
I do believe that the bottom line to all of it is the key is education, and we have to do better in our education system. In it, and I think that we are polarized in it. We have.
And would you, as a taxpayer, be prepared to see a pool of funds dedicated to education for some period of time that the lion's share of it goes to beefing up black? Or are you going to say, well, that ain't fair? Well,
inner city schools, anything. You know, I come from our children have gone to a school that is predominantly white, but we have 40% free and reduced lunch, and people think that it's a you know, a very well-to-do school, and it ranges from you know, doctors and, you know, orthopedic surgeon houses, you know, five blocks from the school to you know, rent houses that have been turned into five unit apartments, rentals, just, you know, slum landlord things. And one of the problems that I've seen in the schools that bothers me is that we need to get money into the schools and reduce the class sizes across the board in all schools, no matter what. When you have one teacher and you have 30 students and you have maybe 15 of those students coming from families that are broken, these children need their only love and attention that they get in a lot of instances is from what they get in school. And a lot of kids are very educatable, but they come to school and they end up acting up and acting out because it's the only way that it's the coping mechanism that they have to get the attention that they need because they don't get it at home. So when you have the 15 children that come from stable families, and they end up being victimized. I don't care what the economic situation is that the kids in the classroom with my children, if all of the kids are paying attention and you have a small enough group that the teacher can handle it. But when you have, for every hour of teacher time, you have the teacher devoting 30 minutes to putting out fires because of the children that don't get the attention that they need, the loving, the nurturing, the one-on-one, the reading, all of these things in the schools. And there's a lot of different ways that that can happen. Pumping money into the schools across the board for the lowering class size, more volunteers. You come from an area where a lot of people are retired, and yet you never get retired people into the schools to read. There's a lot of them that would like to volunteer, but they don't even know that or you get schools or teachers within schools that don't want to have people interfering in their classroom. They'd rather have 32 kids in there and running a free-for-all in the room than to have parents in there seeing what they're doing or volunteering or taking kids out in the hall and reading one-on-one, because these children don't get read to at home. There's just a lot of things that need to be reworked, and part of it is with the primary education system.
No, that's what we're doing. We're really saying we're not going to really be able to do anything about home life.
No.
I mean, we can't do that. So we're going to have to be in a remedial venture right at the start of the... I mean, we're already going remedial. That's amazing.
Smaller class size. And cut out all of these... You have the people that are in the upper ends, the administration of the school districts, and this happens all over the United States. They finally made it out of the classroom. They're working at an $80,000 a year job, pushing paper around. They don't want to give that job up. They don't want to go back to working and so there, you have all of these people. You have a top-heavy school situation, and you need to give combat pay to some teachers to teach in some areas because of the stress level that they have.
You know, there are some school systems that are, my daughter is back in Dubuque, Iowa right now, and they have, she's taking training as a teacher's aide. They have something called the Dubuque Management System. These aides and the teachers themselves are trained on how to work. They say we can't change the home life, but we can help these children grow to see that there are choices in their behavior. So somebody from Washington was back there looking at it. I think there are many schools and many districts that are aware of this particular. She happens to be working in an inner city white area in Dubuque. And these kids have behavior problems. Their fathers are unemployed. Mm-hmm. So whether it's one color or another, there are, I think, caring school districts that are doing it. Just needs more publicity out there too.
There are strong. We happen to have a strong PTA, you know, where our school is, and there are schools that have a lot of participation. But I just think that it's a bottomless pit that you couldn't throw enough money or energy into, because there are every year you get a whole new crop of children coming up through the system that need there's nothing more prophetic than saying it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a lot of people to participate and care about these kids that aren't possibly getting what they need at home. For some kids, they live to come to school. It's the only attention they get. But then when they get there, they don't want to learn because they don't want to sit and do the work, because the attention that they need is cutting up, acting up in school, being the one that, you know, ends up going to the principal's office and talks to the principal, because they are just so needy emotionally, and we can't fill them up.
Seems to me that teachers in mixed classrooms like this, I mean, the resource that they have to distribute, and they want to do it in a just way, okay? Now, they're talking about a just distribution of their resource, which is their time and their effort. Notice how difficult it would be to figure out what constitutes a just distribution of my resource, my time, my effort. How about this? To each according to his effort. Now, the kind of kids we were talking about probably don't exert much effort, so to each according to his effort, you can see that those who are already motivated are going to get. Then it has gets. To each according to his need. Now we're back to where we were.
Yeah,
okay.
And then the kids who come from loving families end up getting sidelined.
Exactly. And that doesn't seem to be fair. No, notice how we got a trade-off here. How about some sort of big all-seeing angels perspective, namely that let's just talk about, you know, raw potential here, and we're going to give it to those who can make the most of themselves. I mean, that may not be related to effort. There might be kids in there who are giving tremendous effort, but they haven't got a lot of national endowment. I mean, why don't we just work with the kids who've got a lot of national endowment so we get the biggest bang for the buck?
And who's going to judge that?
Well, that may be hard. I don't know. There are tests that, you know, that could reveal something like this.
You can tweak the numbers on any test you want to give.
Well, and that's only the academic part. You know, you talk about the different intelligence, you know, the seven different intelligences that don't measure on, you know, an ACT or SAT or an Iowa basic skills test.
You have to have gifted people that care enough that know how to get to some of these children. And sometimes it doesn't happen all through maybe 5, 6, 7 years of schooling, and then you'll get a teacher in eighth grade that'll know how to talk to that kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll turn it around.
Well, I'm just playing
you
with this. As a teacher, I have a mixed bag of kids, you know, small talent, large talent, and I have a resource to distribute. Now, I want to do it justly. Well, I could practice to each according to his need, in which we have to give more of my time and effort to those who need more, okay? Beta grade. To each according to his or her effort. Well, the effort may be a result of prior motivation. Or how about to each one an equal share? Now, what's wrong with that? Equality. To each according to, you know, equally.
Yeah.
Well, that would be fair. Or I'm going to respond to those that raise their hand. Any questions? And I only respond to those that raise their hand. Is that unfair? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you determine how to distribute a valuable resource like this? You know, I want to do it justly. Well, what's the criterion of justice that's going to be the one you operate according to? Because you can't, well, one fights the other.
I think, personally, I think it's a problem that I don't think that we're going to solve easily or soon. But I get frustrated when my children end up being on the reverse end of discrimination because the teacher is spending so much time putting out fires with the kids who are so emotionally needy that the children don't get to do something in school that you know, because they can't start a project, they can't do something as in-depth as the children would be enriching to all of the children, because then you have the kids that are always cutting up. And it's frustrating all the way around. You see the need for the needy ones. You see the children that aren't getting what everybody in the class should be having. The whole class suffers because of, I don't know.
And all these problems start in the sacred zone that we can't touch, which is the preschool home, okay? So all have to deal with it post factum.
And that's why I say, I think, you know, like the gentleman back here said, at least we have to present these opportunities for preschool parents, you know, and pregnant women, you know, to say, you know, if they don't know how to raise a child, at least here are some resources that we have for you. You know, we can't make you attend, we can't make you, you know, do this or that, but at least, you know, if you want to come and learn, you know, this is an opportunity for you.
You could do that with the people who are looking for work also. You can have a resource for them to learn a trade. You know, they didn't finish high school or whatever, but there's a place they can go.
Bring back the WWP and some of those.
Yeah.
We supply
language and reading where I work too. We hire people that can't read or they don't speak English, and we supply that. A couple times a week they come in and we have a teacher teaching. But that gives them an opportunity to move somewhere and move up and better themselves. So maybe you could supply that on a larger scale.
You know, there was some, I'm sure it's heresy, but I heard tell that in some of the upper echelons of the Minnesota, the agency that governs secondary education in Minnesota, there was talk for a while as to whether Minnesota ought to mimic in some way what I understand to be a policy that German schools operate with. And I'm not going to get this completely straight, but roughly the concept is this, that by the time you get to, at least in our school system, you're at the end of your sophomore year of high school and you're going to do your junior year, that you have two tracks now, okay? You got track A, both are ways of finishing the college or the high school degree. Track A, you know what I'm going to say, will be college prep, okay? And that requires, you know, a certain amount of courses that prepare you, you know, for college. And the other one still gives you a high school degree, but it's allied with apprenticeships, you know, in the community, working as a mechanic or working so. So when you get out, at least you've got some marketable skill. You don't have to go to a full tech or something. And this is a really interesting plan here because parents, in consultation with the guidance counselor, would end up saying, okay, tentatively at this juncture, I think Johnny should go in the apprentice program or something. It's not an irrevocable decision, but you'd already make that so you don't end up with complexions of freshman classes like I get at the University of Wisconsin, in which you've got kids that don't have any marketable skills. They're really not interested in being in college, but they have no skills.
But daddy's making them do that.
And they're just sitting there like duds. I mean, they're brain dead, and I can't do anything with them. And they don't want to be there. I don't want them to be there. But we're babysitting. That's what we're doing. I mean, it's a big babysitting service. So at least that plan.
There are some businesses that are participating in some things like that, but I don't think it's wide scale enough at this point. And I think that it has to be marketed in some way that makes it appealing to private business to invest in it.
I grew up many years ago in Milwaukee. At that time, they were using that system.
Did it work?
They had vocational high schools.
Yeah.
And at that time, they didn't have a lot of counselors, and depending on your grades, you had the choice of going. And I don't know if Milwaukee's still doing it, but I know that at that time, it seemed to be working very well.
I've heard 60-year-olds tell me, you've got to be kidding. I've even heard 22-year-olds say, if I had to make that decision as a 60-year-old, I wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're clueless. I mean,
you're still getting your basic, you know, grammar and English and math and things. So it's just a different kind of environment.
Why can't you have an available, you know, some guy's 25 and he's decided that, hey, I have to start to make money. You know, it's just kind of dawned on him, but he has no college, and he wants to learn something. So, you know, as an employer, as a state or whatever, to get him. Get them off welfare or whatever, and you want to hire them, and you want manpower that they can go somewhere and get some type of education so they can bring them into the workforce. I think they drop out before high school.
There are some that train people. I mean, there are job services.
Yeah, there are. Weren't there at Stevens Point that one company or something? It would bring in high school kids, sort of an apprentice program. But I know it would pay.
I think there's some other programs, too.
But then the kicker was that the expectation was that when the person graduated, they'd have to work at least a year or something for the corporation that funded the...
Well, that's a corporation, but I think there's some even government programs that will be our job training programs.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things with kids, teenagers, is that you... I work for a law enforcement agency, and where we happen to be located, the unit that I work in, is across the alley from the alternative school that the kids go to, court mandated after they are out of every other program. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the real hardcore kids, and they're so angry. They are, I mean, it's so sad to see these kids. They're so caught up in their anger, and they really don't even know who that the anger needs to be focused at. They're just angry, and so they would spike their own possibilities to prove their anger or their position that they feel that they are in at that moment. And it's so sad to see these kids get to past the age of where we will help them with education, and they've just basically, if it hasn't already been flushed down the toilet for them, they do the last flush. And you then you get the kids that are 20 years old, haven't even qualified for a GED or any kind of an education. They have no skills. They've homemade tattoos on themselves, and you know, pierce their eyebrows, and want to go and get a job at Boeing. You know, and you know, it's frustrating. It's really frustrating to see these kids, and it's sad. And you wonder who's at home, who's awake. You know, what's happening with these children?
I'm really puzzled. We started out by talking about a minimum level of qualification. We started out by talking about candidates that had achieved a minimum level of job qualification and making a decision between two minimally qualified applicants. And over the course of this hour or whatever it has been, we're now at the point where it seems to me that we're characterizing African Americans as coming from poorly parented homes, as being unwed mothers, as being
We're talking across the board.
I'm really concerned that we're not balancing that at all in our conversation here.
You know, when they gave their examples, we've got tons of examples of white children. I mean, I thought they were talking about whites. Yeah. Because all my, you know, when I can think of illustrations from our own experience, they're all white. I mean, so it wasn't meant to be.
So we've finished our discussion, and we've gone into another discussion. That's what I'm not understanding.
I think we're implying that we think it's education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking what quality education across the board, regardless of who the recipient would be, what that would look like,
and how education is going to affect employment.
For no matter who.
Let me give you an example of something that our school did. Like I told you before, we have it's a 40% free and reduced lunch in a predominantly white neighborhood in Everett. We have a lot of single family parents. We don't have very many black kids, but we do have some. We have a lot of other minorities, Russians, Hispanics. Our PTA a couple years ago, and it actually didn't start with the PTA, it started with a school counselor that suggested uniforms. What would you think about uniforms for children in a public school? We have uniforms, and we have done 1 year of uniforms at our school, and after 1 year, I would say that I feel that there is an improvement in the education atmosphere in our school, and the real push came from the very well-to-do families who could afford to put their kids in anything from Nordstrom's or, you know, L.L. Bean, anything. They could buy anything. They wanted to see that there was less status and class throughout this school, and they pushed for the uniforms. We have very genetic, you know, blue pants, brown pants, white top or whatever, school sweatshirt, and we went through a year with it, and the counselors that suggested it said that we had four non-uniform days throughout the school. The referral to the counselor's office went through the roof on the non-uniform days when the kids were in uniform.